This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with blogger J-Man. J-Man, it's great talking to you.
Thank you very much. Great talking to you. Thanks for having me on.
And I'm also joined here with Sam Kevorkian and Joshua Zeidner.
Great to be on the show again.
Same here.
J-Man, you write a lot about HBD, human biodiversity, as well as a lot of cultural and sociological issues. What originally got you interested in the topic?
Well, to go back to the beginning, I read Steven Pinker's The Blank Slate shortly after it came out, and that was a book that it really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And you know, Pinker talks a lot about human nature and biological underpinnings of behavior and how it's rooted in our evolutionary past. He deliberately glossed over race differences, I think. He created what another blogger, Stefan, termed half-slateism as opposed to the blank slate. You know, he created the half slate where it's like half full and you have genes determining one thing and supposedly cultural and environmental forces determine the rest. And for years, you know, I pretty much left it at that. And, you know, the question of group-wide differences, biological group differences, it lingered in the back of my mind, but I didn't really give it too much thought for the first couple of years. But I knew it was always a possibility. And then afterwards I started seriously looking at it, and that's when I got introduced to Saylor stuff, Steve Saylor stuff. And, you know, I really looked at, some of the things he said, and I found them very, very interesting. From there, I think, the thing that really tipped it was, J.P. Rushton and Arthur Jensen's paper. They made a really detailed paper, making the case for black-white differences in IQ. And it really attached all the scientific objections to it, so I really had to take it seriously at that point. And to be a little immodest here, I mean, the idea of that evolution had to continue up to the present time was something that I basically figured out in middle school. As soon as I understand the idea of evolution and natural selection and all that, that different human groups that have been in different environments for long periods of time would have accumulated differences, and that, of course, that's the case. So from there, you know, so recently there's Saylor and Russian stuff, and then pretty much the floodgates opened from there, and, you know, the rest is history, so to speak.
And what's interesting is most people in the HBD sphere, I'd say it's pretty much practically overwhelmingly white. You're from a mixed background. You're of Jamaican descent, but also African, English, Chinese, and Indian.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my family is very typically Jamaican. It's like, you know, most Americans that, you know, Razi Khan talks about this a lot when, how much people, Americans, don't know about other parts of the world. But, yeah, I mean, there are many of Jamaicans of mixed ancestry. My family, both my mom and my dad are mixed, and so I'm mostly African, but I'm also part European, and like most blacks, and I'm part East Asian, and apparently part South Asian too from my dad's side. I've never gotten that tested. I still haven't gotten around to getting the 23andMe yet. I really want to do that, but I haven't done it yet.
Another interesting thing about you is you said that you lean to the left politically on both economic and social issues. I know there is this kind of whole concept of an alt-left, or remember a while back Robert Lindsay, that blogger, liberal race realism. But it was interesting as you talk about your views, and you actually make some cases where left-wing politics are compatible with HBD. I think you give a number of examples. One is Planned Parenthood. And you talk about some conservative fallacies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, the facts are kind of secondary to values. That's the key thing. I mean, that you can give people a bunch of facts and you know, different people will come up with different things to do based on their individual values. And in my case, I am definitely more on the liberal side. Certainly not progressive, as modern progressivism, because, you know, I'm a big heathen on that one. But, I mean, I believe in socialism, you know, in a strong welfare state, and I believe in I'm not a social conservative. I'm certainly very socially liberal. My views were definitely classically liberal. And in the HBD and the loosely affiliated alt-right sphere, obviously, you know, some of that, especially just socially liberal views, are pretty taboo. But, I mean, you know, as I talk about, they don't really have a lot of basis in fact, necessarily. I mean, the things that they tend to believe to support them don't necessarily follow. So,
you wrote an article a while back called Possible Solutions, mm-hmm. and these were about solutions to a lot of these sociological issues that we're having. One thing you touch upon is immigration policy. I think this is worth bringing up because there's this whole bill out called the RAISE Act, which I think Trump is supporting. And you actually have an interesting point that there's talk of a point system which takes into account English proficiency, economic wealth, the number of, I think age is also a factor. You actually point out that certain countries should be given priority, so you have a ranking with Europe, the Anglosphere, and Israel, followed by Japan, the rest of Asia, and then you list some other countries.
Well, I don't actually know the specifics of that particular, but I wasn't following it. But I mean, but in general, the one of the things that follows from human biodiversity, reality group differences, is that the composition of a population affects the society that it exists in. And, you know, because the people create the society. See, that the modern Western thought is that society creates the people, when it's actually very much the opposite. And so it follows from that if you're interested in the quality and characteristics of society, that you need to control the people that make it up. And so immigration policy would then seem to be important at that point. And if you have people immigrate to your country from populations that don't necessarily have values similar to yours, the nature of your society would change. I mean, you know, one of the biggest myths is something that I've talked about earlier, is that, a lot of immigration uses turn of the 20th century immigration of Southern Eastern Europeans and Catholic Irish as an example of assimilation, how they've assimilated to American values, and when they really didn't. I mean, they assimilated in very superficial ways. You know, they changed their language, they may have changed what they wore, you know, they may have changed marriage customs and things like that. But I mean, a lot of the other things remain constant. You know, their political views, their attitudes towards cooperation and trust and all those things, those things pretty much kept the way they were all along. And what actually happened is as they merged with American society, so that they've changed America itself, that America post turn of the century migration was quite different from America from before. And that has become the America that we know. Now, of course, in today's world, we have another period like that with large-scale immigration, and you're having people mostly from Latin America and East Asia coming over, and, well, East and South Asia. And if you allow that to continue, they will also continue to change the society. I mean, the impact they're having is smaller, I think, than the earlier waves of European impact, because they're just simply a smaller proportion of the population now. But that's not always going to be the case. The Hispanics especially are increasing their share of the population, and you know, they're changing the nature of society along with it. And, a lot of that is contrary to what the alt-right is bemoaning, is innocuous. I mean, you know, culture may change and all this, and, you know, maybe some, you know, for people from more clannish populations is, and HBD chick talk about, come in, they're going to be more
you know, more clannish and less trust-based way of doing things. But, you know, the chains all in all is innocuous. It's those that come from more, when you have more lower IQ populations coming in, you're going to have less economic vitality, more crime, and then you're going to have serious problems. So it stands to reason that what would help be most helpful in immigration is the biggest thing, if you did nothing else, and if you could do one thing, is just to cut the amount of immigration, the quantity needs to get cut down. If you could get it down to somewhere like 30 to 10% of what it is now, then even, you know, the composition would be a factor, but not that big of a problem. You know, so the by far the largest problem is the sheer volume.
So wrote about a welfare reform, and you said welfare should incentivize childlessness, because right now the welfare state favors people who have more kids. This kind of gets into the topic of eugenics, but you think there should be a favoritism towards individuals over families?
All right. So broadly, yes, I'm pro-eugenics. Pro-voluntary eugenics. None of the coercive eugenics. None of that bullcrap that from before. But eugenics by itself isn't a bad thing. I mean, the idea is that you want to have more of certain traits in the society. You know, that's not a bad thing. And the way you do that is by how things breed. I mean, society is going to... like Greg Cochran has said, Gregory Cochran says that every society selects for something. So you're going to have selection for some traits no matter what you do. So one of the things to be concerned about is that if you want certain traits of society, you want to encourage breeding to go in that direction. But, I mean, this is a very complex, difficult topic to actually implement. I mean, the concepts behind it are simple. The breeder's equation, which is the fundamental thing that governs selection. You know, I can read it, but I can't say it. R is equal to H squared S. Yes, right. Right, R equal to H squared S. Yeah, it's responsive selection is the product of the additive heritability times the selective differential. So, I mean, that governs all of evolution, basically. One of the key things with that is that this is what determines the pace of selection. So one of the things about that is that while we may or may not be having what's known as dysgenic fertility, it's not really happening in a rapid pace in the moment. So it's not a dam being broken that we have to address right now, but it is a long-term problem. The thing, though, is that it seems to be very, very difficult to actually get people to modify their childbearing behavior.
You're saying you disagree with conservatives who place all the blame on the welfare state, and they think if only we get rid of the welfare state, all these problems will go away?
No, the problems certainly won't go away. I mean, you know, if you did that, it depends on what did they mean by problems. I mean, what those conservatives are railing against is sexual liberalization. And the welfare state assists with that, but that's not the fundamental cause. The fundamental cause is technological changes. You know, we have an excess of food. We have birth control. Those are the things that cause sexual liberalization. And, you know, since as I've talked about, that parenting doesn't have such a parenting... family structure, father presence or absence doesn't have any long-term impact in child development. You know, all the things they're railing against about broken homes and all those things don't really matter. So, I mean, that's what they're mostly worried about. I mean, it's certainly if you change people's sexual behavior or their mating, their marriage patterns or anything like that, you're not going to see an immediate change in the way society is. And you're certainly not going to see any change in the population structure. So, You know, to worry about the welfare state, to worry about birth control and all those things, you know, on the list of things you should be worried about, that doesn't rank very high at all. And the thing, though, is that when you want to get eugenic fertility or fertility for higher IQ, for you know, low crime propensity, when you want to get those things and you want to get the right type of people to have more children, it's actually very hard to get people to do that. And I see firsthand why that is, in a way, why that is. Because, you know, children are demanding. And it's just something in our modern world where they've become optional. It's just not something that we can really do much about.
Some things that you point out in the article is you do talk about subsidizing childbirth with generous cash bonuses to the educated and accomplished individuals. You also talk about student loan forgiveness, but another interesting point is that you were talking about, I think you were talking about Europe. You're actually saying that birth rates are actually higher in the more socialist and liberal parts of Europe, and that kind of goes against the right-wing narrative that declining birth rates are a product of liberalism.
Yeah, well, yeah, so let me talk about that. I mean, that in the alt-right, they mentioned that for modern liberal society has crashed fertility, and it has, in a way. I mean, if your point of comparison is fertility in, like, 50 or 75 years ago compared to today, yeah. But if you look at Europe today, and you look at the fertility rates are highest, I mean, and I'm talking native fertility, because I'm not counting immigrant population, but native fertilities are highest in Northwestern Europe and significantly lower in Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. You know, the countries that, you know, they have welfare states, but they're not as strong, and they're more traditional compared to Northwestern Europeans, and yet they have much lower fertility rates. I mean, I understand Russia and that Anatoly Karelin talks about a lot how their fertility has been coming back up, but it still lags behind what I believe. I haven't looked at it lately, so if I'm wrong on that, you know.
Is that number counted including the Muslim population, or is
I don't know about Russia, but I know in Northwestern
I'm talking about the numbers you mentioned about Western Europe.
Yeah, Northwestern Europe, the fertility rates are the native fertility rates of the native populations, not counting immigrant groups, are indeed higher than they are in Eastern and Southern Europe in general.
That's somewhat surprising to me.
Also fertility, though, except maybe Ireland. But it's still, you know, it's like 1.7, 1.8 children per woman versus 1.2 or 1.1 as you find in Eastern and Southern Europe. So.
Do you think a factor is a generous subsidization? Say a woman wants to stay at home and there's a generous paid maternity leave, and also the student loan debt thing you touched upon too?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know because these things are, you know, it's really hard to test social policy because it's not like you can put it to a randomized controlled trial. But it could also just simply be because the economy is better. I mean, people simply have more money, you know, and more money helps with having more children. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think the subsidies hurt, certainly. And it might very well help. Now, the big problem with socialism in America, aside from the clannish populations, which I'm sure we'll get to when we talk about American nations. But, I mean, the big problem in America is that since we have large non-European populations in the United States, I mean, much larger than any European country has. And conservatives in the States see any socialist policy as benefiting the non-whites at the expense of whites, and they're not wrong about that. And it would be much more expensive to implement Western European-style socialism in the United States for that reason. And that's a big reason why I don't think it's ever actually going to get that far, at least not in the foreseeable future, unfortunately.
Are there ways to implement socialism in the United States that would address these issues? What do you think about, say, the basic income?
Basic income is interesting. I mean, yeah, it's the Gulf Arab states have it. Alaska has one, you know. So it's clearly not impossible. But to have it in a wide scale in America, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. It might happen eventually. It probably will creep in at some point. But contrary to something Charles Murray had wrote some time ago about how, or not if he specifically argued this, but I have heard this argument that somehow basic income would be cheaper because it would replace the welfare state. You really couldn't do that because, the difference, the things that lead you to have the welfare state in the first place, the fact that you have lower IQ and, less economically vital populations in your society, those aren't going to change. So, I don't know. I'm not really sure if the basic incomes could work in the United States. I'd imagine it might eventually, but I don't really know. I mean, I guess looking at European countries that implemented, Finland is experimenting. I know they voted on it in Switzerland at one point, and seeing how they do with it might be a start.
You did write this article, Idiocracy Can Wait. There's this big perception in the kind of HBD sphere that there is this massive scale to eugenics. But it's more, you're pointing out it's more complex than that. And I think one factor is a lot of people in the middle class they're not having kids simply because they can't afford them. And people in the ultra rich or the moderately wealthy, they have the luxury of having more kids. So your point in this article is the whole idiocracy narrative is too simplistic.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, this goes back to something Greg Cochran says, that, I mean, even to the extent that dysgenics is going on, and it is, what we've lost in IQ points is at most, like, one or two IQ points over the last 100 years. Yes, yes. And Michael Woodley might be listening, and he's wrong. We have not lost 10 or 15 points. That just simply hasn't happened. One or two points at most. So dysgenics to the extent that's happened is very slow. And what I found in that thing is that it might not even, at least for the 1960s cohorts, it might have stalled or reversed, partly because there is a sex difference in fertility by IQ that when you look at, and I looked at whites only, by the way, when you look at men, you find that higher IQ men, more educated men, have more children than less educated men, and for women it's the exact opposite. So at least for the 1960s cohort, that either balanced out or actually caused a slight eugenic fertility because of it. So to the extent that dysgenics is going on, at least for IQ anyway, it's either very slow or it might even be neutral or positive at the moment. Who knows?
Has there been any extensive research on this?
Well, I looked at this at the GSS. It would be nice to look at it in the Global Social Survey. It'd be nicer to look at this in a larger sample. And I suppose that could be another project of mine. To look at fertility rates by education. Because, I mean, people in the 1970s cohort, and, I'm a 70 child myself, we're still having children, so probably that's the most recent thing you could really look at. I'm sure someone out there may have done it. I haven't seen it. But it would definitely be nice to look at in a larger sample to see what's actually happening instead of just assuming. Because a lot of the dysgenics is based on just simply looking at women and not considering men also. I mean, you get your intelligence from both parents equally, so that's a... definitely when it comes to women, education is negatively correlated with fertility, but for men it's the opposite, so it might balance out.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for you. So sure. I'm a little bit confused about your stance.
Okay.
So are you
Yeah, it's kind of confusing, huh? Go ahead.
Okay, are you a white supremacist?
Oh, certainly not. This would be hard since I'm pretty black. I mean,
right, that would be kind of self-deprecating, judging by what you had already. Okay, so but you do admit that there are racial categories, right? I mean, you're not
race is real. I mean, it's ancestry is real and race is real. I mean,
okay, so and also IQ differs according to race. That's also
IQ reasonable. And other traits differ by group. I mean,
so then which races have the highest IQ?
Okay, so it's just the basic. This comes from Richard Lin's data. Northeast Asians have the highest average IQ, around 105, 106. And then Northern Europeans around 100. And then, you know, Southern Europeans is usually in the mid to high 90s. And then you have most of the mid, the subtropical latitude peoples usually have some IQ in the 80s or 90s. And you have African groups test in the 70s. And of course, you have various hunter-gatherer groups that are even lower than that. That's the general pattern.
Okay, so then, I mean, given some of the other things that you had said about eugenics, it seems like you're almost favoring that, you know, we weed out the characteristics that are associated with some races, which, I mean, I guess...
Well, on average, just about every... Any characteristic you can think of can be found most, for the most... broadly speaking, any characteristic you can think of is found in virtually every race. It's just that it's not in equal proportions. You know,
true.
There are plenty of Africans that you would love to have around. I mean, hell, you know, one of them was at least part of our president, so at least half African.
Well, there's actually an interesting find that they made. I did quite a bit of research on the Y DNA haplogroups,
mm-hmm.
and it's an interesting fact that they discovered was that, you know, there's a Y DNA haplogroup associated with Caucasians. It's called the R1 Y-DNA haplogroup.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one is associated with some groups of Indians, some Northern Europeans, Vikings, Poles, Russians, a couple other groups. I think Ukrainians might have them in high proportion.
Native Americans also have R. I don't think R1, but...
Native Americans are O's.
No,
mostly
it,
O's.
Yeah, there is
let me just finish this
group for Native Americans.
Let me just finish this thought. You guys can talk about other. I mean, it's a very fascinating subject. Lots of things to discuss.
Right, right.
But one thing that they discovered is this R1A group. It is the youngest group. So the way that you're talking, it's almost like, well, every race kind of has its own thing. But really, you know, what they discovered was that the genes that are associated with whiteness are actually the latest genetic development in humanity. So, you know, they're the cutting edge of evolution, according to science.
Well, the timing of appearance of traits isn't necessarily related to the quality of traits. You know, certain things can appear late and not necessarily be the most economically productive. But yeah, Europeans, as they're known today, don't go back that far. I mean, Razi Khan talked about it, that they're only about 4,000 or 5,000 years old. And certainly the traits that we think about for Northwestern Europeans are even younger than that. They only appeared, H.B. Dietrich talks about them, like the crux of her thing. Those only appeared in the last 1,000 to 2,000 years.
What had happened was, I mean, if you look at the map, you know, they're able to kind of map these genes to ancient migrations. You can see these on maps. And what had happened was, you know, a group of humanity from the Middle East, well, I mean, it started in Africa, as far as they understand it to be. Then they went up to the Middle East, and they had a kind of simple, primitive culture. And then a small group of them migrated up into the very, very cold regions. And it would appear that, you know, the harsh environment, I guess it bred out a lot of the unwanted genes. And that's essentially what produced what we today call white people. They're really an offshoot of Asian.
Here's the thing. I mean, we're finding a lot of, even just the last few years, a lot of things about migration is found to be very complicated. Like, you know, so certain human groups that exist today split off from humanity close to when modern humans appeared, like the Bushmen in Africa split off from humanity about 250,000 years ago. And Pygmies are, I think, about the same, 200 to 300,000 years ago. So a lot of what the outer Africa idea, that one human group emerged from Africa, was thought to be 50,000-60,000 years ago and gave rise to other humans, that it turns out to be slightly more complicated, that may be a bit older than that. But on top of that, you have, since humans first entered Eurasia, you've had so many migrations and mapping forth moments and population merging and all these different things going on. Some of it you can see if you just even look at recorded history, you get an idea of what could have happened. And so the picture turns out to be pretty complicated. In Europe, particular, in general, the environment selects. I mean, this is true for all life. The environment selects for the traits that are best suited to that environment over time. When you look at Europe, there seems to be the three general waves of population that contribute to modern Europeans. There were ancient hunter-gatherers who were then mostly replaced by farmers coming out of the Middle East. They started in Southern Europe, then moved to Northern Europe. And those people were completely replaced by people coming from the steppes more Central Asia, Eastern Europe area, mostly completely replaced them in Northern Europe and partly replaced and mixed in Southern Europe. And that, you know, is what gave, you know, sowed the seed from modern Europeans that we know.
That's right. I mean, and that group that you just mentioned, just to clarify it for the listeners, who came in from the steppes, that was the R1A group, or at least the R1 group. R1B.
Yeah, they're probably one of the arguers.
You have this series, the American Nation series, and this is published on the Owns Review. Yes. I think to start things off is you start off this series with America's founding fathers, the colonial era, and I think people have a tendency to view the colonists as one monolithic group. You really analyze all the different groups that settled the Eastern Shore. You talk about the Puritans, the Cavaliers who came. They came from the western part of England and Wales, and they settled the American South. You talk about the French Canadians, the Dutch.
Yes. So I mean, the general idea. This goes from Albion Seed, the book. Which talks about how the different colonial Americans were from different parts of England, of the British Isles, and. Right, I mean, the colonial settlers were definitely very different groups from different parts of England with different motivations, and they settled different parts of the country. And from there, they basically moved west, more or less going due west, more or less, and so that formed distinct regions going across the continent from north to south. And in New England, you had the Puritans, who were mostly from East Anglia and parts of southeastern England. The Pennsylvania area, you had the Quakers, who were from Yorkshire and around there.
So the Quakers were more the most egalitarian.
They preached egalitarianism. I don't know if that was actually practiced, because they were more. Whereas there's a gradient I talked about in related to something H.B. Dietrich talks about in the strength of the nuclear versus extended family, and it goes from more nuclear to more extended as you go from Puritans to Quakers to Cavaliers to the Borderland or Scotch Irish. That the Puritans were more nuclear centric, and extended family was kind of viewed as something outside and detached, and the Quakers were a little less so. The Cavaliers were even more less so. They were more focused on extended families and breeding. Breeding was very important to the Cavaliers, breeding and pedigrees. And then you have the Scots-Irish, which were, they were pretty much classically clannish, as we know. They gave rise to, the great clan feuds like the Hatfield McCoys and such. That was definitely one gradient that reflects in the cultures that they founded. So they settled different parts of the country. The Puritans, for example, they started in Boston area and in New England, and eventually they moved west to areas around the Great Lakes. The Quakers, they settled around Pennsylvania and Philadelphia area. They didn't move as much, but they were also joined by Germans from the Palatine area, and they pretty much were the ones who moved. Settled more western areas and opened up the Midwest sort of. pretty much followed the path of Interstate 80 today and settled westward from there. And then you have the, in a Virginia area, you have the Cavaliers who set up the Plantation Society there, and they settled the area that's like known today for tobacco growing in the Tidewater area. You had another branch of Cavaliers that started in Charleston, and they established the sugar planting culture. Well, you know, sugar and cotton. They came from Barbados and they found the Deep South, moving westward there along the coast. And
so, would that be Alexander Hamilton was from Barbados?
Yeah.
No, he was from Nevis. Wasn't he from Nevis? I'm not completely sure, but I'm pretty sure that Hamilton was raised in the Isle of Nevis, which is close to Barbados.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the Caribbean, the planet and Deep South, the Caribbean plantation societies where they're proving down. So they wanted to transplant that to America and, you know, establish the plantation slave society that they had there.
And you have this map, the American nations today. And I think to start off on the East Coast, you talk about these different regions. Yankeedom is basically New York, New England, northern Pennsylvania, and parts of the upper Midwest. Then there's a greater Appalachia, which is those Scotch-Irish, and that extends all the way to Oklahoma and Texas. Then there's the Deep South.
Okay, so... So this comes from Colin Woodard's book, The American Nations, and he was one of the books that I read after Albion Sea, and, you know, he definitely talks about how the settlement patterns helped make the modern society of today, and, but the general thing is that in Yankeedom, the greater New England era, is more egalitarian, is more community-oriented, it's more about the common good, whereas in the Deep South, for example, it's more individualistic, or as H.B. Dietrich would say, individualistic from government and more pro-family. You know, they don't really have such an idea of a common good. It's more of a kin-focused way of looking at things. This precipitated a lot of conflicts. Of course, the biggest example being the Civil War itself. But you can see this perpetuated in many different aspects of today's American society. A lot of the differences that persist today aren't so much from the original colonists, at least certainly not in the northern parts of the country, because they've had so many immigrants come in to overrun and outnumber the colonial population. So, in a way, some of the differences now follow that way because immigrants that came in, especially in the early part of the 20th century and today, mostly settled in the northern and western parts of the country. They didn't really go to the south. So, their society is a bit more intact in terms of its culture and such from the past. Whereas the northern parts have absorbed immigrants from different parts, so they've kind of changed a bit because of that. But because of self-selection and other things, you know, the immigrants that came in were sort of the ones that were more compatible with society here. Like in the upper Midwest, they got a lot of Scandinavians, which kind of, you know, Scandinavians fit in with the more community, common good orientation of the Puritans than, say they would have fit in the South, for example. And a lot of this, Midwest got a lot of Germans in addition to the Germans that were coming in from the East. These different groups have gone on and they've created distinctions that follow the patterns of distinctions of the past. And, you know, this continues to play out in the conflicts that we see in the country today. I mean, a lot of it's certainly as our political process gets more polarized, it starts to become more evident in the geography, the split between the different parts of the country.
Oh, yeah, I think you did write about the American nations and Trump, but Trump's strongest support was a coalition of the South, especially the descendants of the Scotch-Irish, but also Irish and Italian Catholics in the Northeast and the Rust Belt.
Yeah, I mean, at least though in the primaries, there was a geographic division between Trump and Cruz, for example. And Trump was definitely stronger with the Italians, with Scotch-Irish, with Catholic-Irish than he was with, say, English or Scandinavians or Germans. And so, you know, those other groups went more for Cruz on the Republican side. And, of course, you know, during the general election, you saw something closer to the normal pattern, except that, I guess, in this past election differed from 2008 and 2012 in that, you know, Northern, Western Yankeedom, that area, the upper Great Lakes, kind of went more for Trump this time. But, I mean, if you looked at, I don't think anyone's actually broke down, did a map of the white-only vote and looked at it by degree of margin of victory.
Lion of the Blogosphere did it for New York City, and he analyzed the groups, how they voted, and I think he was just doing it for New York City, but he said Italians, Russians, and Orthodox Jews voted for Trump. That was just for New York City.
Yeah. I mean, Trump has a classic, more classic alpha male type personality that appeals more.
I have a question for you.
Yeah,
if you don't mind. So you're attributing these political divisions to genetics? Is that essentially your?
One of the things I talk about, one of my latest posts was about the five laws of behavioral genetics. And let me recap what the laws are. The first law is, you know, they're put in the order of importance, which is great. But the first law is just plain all human behavioral traits are heritable. I mean, there is no human trait, not one, that has been looked at that does not have some kind of genetic input impact on. So genes affect everything. It affects politics, affects religion. You know, I mean, behavioral traits, as we know, that come from, you know, genes, you know, in addition to other things. But that's one of the reasons you see persistent political differences, because you have genetic differences between people. And when you, on the group level, when you look at a group level, when there are group differences, you're going to have these political differences. And that's one of the reasons that you have the regional separation in the United States. That's one of the divisions. Well, let me just finish the laws of behavioral genetics that I talked about, because that's also important. The second law is that the effects of the growing up in the same family is smaller than the effects of genes, which basically means that family effects are nil. I mean, they're just not found. If you look at twins raised apart, they're just as alike as twins raised together. You look at adopted children growing up together, spending their whole lives together, they're not alike at all. I mean, they're no more similar than random strangers. Half siblings growing up together are no more similar than half siblings growing apart. You know, you look at many different ways, you just don't find an effect of family environments. And that's one of the key things in Western belief, that families are very important for, you know, family and pretty much everything that children growing up together share, you know, schools and neighborhoods, etc. All those things that are thought to be very important to behavioral development, and they're not. You know, there's just no impact of those things when you look at large samples. I mean, and these are things that, you know, in the early behavioral genetic studies were a lot smaller, but, you know, we have much bigger studies now, and we still don't find these shared environment effects, as they're known as. That probably was one of the biggest shocks to people. In addition to the first law, that all behavioral traits are heritable, so the second thing, the thing that, you know, okay, you know, my, you know, people get the idea that my kid is going to be, you know, one certain way because of his genes, but maybe if I raise him right, give him the right examples, and all those things will come out one day. And it turns out, no, that's not the case. Those won't have any impact whatsoever. I mean, the way you treat your kid will affect how your kid treats you, and how your kid treats their, you know, his or her siblings, but it won't affect how your kid goes on to treat the rest of the world. And, you know, that's one of the big shocks to a lot of people. And
so would you advocate that, you know, different racial types be segregated? You know, as in, like, let's
No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, if that's true, what you just said there, then the best way to structure society is to at least designate and segregate these various groups so that, you know, we can gear one educational system towards one group and gear another educational system towards another group. That would be the ideal, right?
No. There's no reason to do that, to separate groups. I will say that if that's something you wanted to happen, you don't really have to do anything because groups will self-segregate essentially.
Yeah,
because,
true.
Right. You know, homophily is the thing that people prefer to live with people like themselves, and you know it is that, by the way, has nothing to do with kin altruism or ethnic genetic interests that you may hear floating around. There's no such thing as a race-based group altruism because you're somehow related to your distant relatives and all that, because you know that's shown to be silly, that you don't send Christmas cards to your second and third cousins or in general. You know, people are pretty detached from them, at least in the Western societies in general. There is such a thing as seeking out similar traits, you know, assortative migration, assortative mating. You look for people who are like yourself, and that leads to people to self-segregate, basically. I mean, and I don't think that should be discouraged or encouraged. I mean, it's just something that's just going to happen.
What's fascinating is in your map of the American nations you posted from that book, a lot of the blocks are kind of ethnic-based, like Greater Appalachia on the Scotch-Irish, the Upper Midwest and the Germans and Scandinavians, New England with the English. But then we have the Far West and the Left Coast. And those two areas, they don't really have an ethnic identity. But I would say the Far West has its identity based on the Old West, and there's still a kind of a strong sense of individualism. And the Left Coast has a strong kind of a Sweppel culture. They're very into being eco-friendly, but there's not really an ethnic identity. And I mean, I would say people, including myself, white people in California, are generally like a mixture of different European ethnic groups.
Yeah, the Western nations, the Far West and Left Coast, those aren't based so much on ethnicity. Those are more based on what I mentioned before, assortative migration. It's that people with certain personality types from all different ethnic backgrounds all came to there because, certainly today because it appeals to them, and economic circumstances in earlier times. So that created a certain type of people. In the Left Coast in particular, I did a map on personality traits across different parts, and you find that people out west are more introverted, for one thing. You know, I've heard people comment on that in Seattle, you'll find a lot more single-person cars, and, you know, one commenter over at HBD Chicks at one time mentioned that people in the Pacific Northwest, they go out to campgrounds and they all have their own campers and keep to themselves. You know, they're very introverted and more higher on the personality trait of openness to experience. You know, those are traits associated with artistic appreciation and all those things that you mentioned when you think of typical West Coasters. Self-sorting essentially created those nations.
Was there some connection to another region? So was the Pacific Northwest primarily settled by people from, say, the Upper Midwest, and the Southwest was settled by people from the South? Was that a factor?
That does contribute. Like the initial settlement of the Left Coast and the Pacific Northwest, in particular, came from New England. Like Portland, Oregon, is actually named after Portland, Maine. They're here in Maine. You know, the settlers that, the very first settlers actually sailed for 6 months all the way around.
There was also Russians.
Yeah.
There's a large Russian component to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
That most people don't talk about.
Yeah, because they were Russian colonists. The original European settlers were Russians, in fact. I don't know how much of a democratic input they've left today, though.
Yeah, there is a Russian fort in Sonoma County in Northern California.
Yeah.
I think they kind of moved away. I don't think they left a permanent mark.
Still many old believers up there. It's like a subset of Russian Orthodoxy. And yeah, I imagine a lot of them also just bred in with the general white population.
Yeah, I mean, you know, after you had the New England migrants over to the Northwest, you had other people coming over. So a lot of Appalachians came there. Into the Southern California, even got California in general, got a lot of people from Appalachia and from the Great Plains in general during the Dust Bowl. They came over. You had the Okies, for example. But yeah, I mean, a lot of, if you look at the linguistic affinity, like the language of the Northwest, I think, is more closely aligned with New England a bit.
I've even heard people say there's a San Francisco accent that's different than, say, an LA accent.
Yes, there's a map. There's one of the maps I've talked about. There's a that I featured is a map of American dialects that did pretty much all the dialects of North America, and you have San Francisco as an interesting linguistic island.
There was
does
an app
this map have sound samples?
Oh yeah, it has sound samples. It's a complete resource. I mean,
can you
the name? The post maps of American nations. The map is there, and I have a link to the site. The name of it's escaping me. I think it's Ashman Clan. I want to say.
There was an app once on, I think it was a Wall Street Journal, if I'm not mistaken, and they would ask you like a series of questions, maybe about 20 questions about how you pronounce things, and they could tell you exactly where you were from. And
for me,
it was like it was extremely precise. I remember one of the questions was how to pronounce drawer, like a sock drawer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how do you guys pronounce the word drawer? How do you say sock drawer?
Drawer.
Draw.
Some people say drawer. Others will say draw. You know.
Say draw. You know, no, the New York City part is coming out when I say draw. I mean draw. I mean,
but New Yorkers say draw. Absolutely.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I did one of those tests actually, and they got it pretty much spot on. That I my language was New York City first, and then also New England, and those are the parts that I pretty much spent my whole life on. So they got that pretty spot on.
What do you think about these growing kind of demographic blocks? So you have the concept of El Norte in the Southwest of primarily Mexican Americans,
yes,
but there's also a growing Asian block in the West as well.
Yes, yes. It was interesting that El Norte, for example, as Colin Wood had described it, was based on the pretty much the earlier Mexican populations that had lived there. And you still find some of that in, like, say, New Mexico or, you know, southern Texas along the Mexican border. Those are populations of Mexicans that have actually been there for many generations. But a bulk of the population there now are actually recent immigrants. And they're not even from just across the border. A lot of Mexican immigrants actually come from central and southern Mexico, which is interesting. So they've basically migrated through Mexico, you know, to come to the United States.
Overwhelmingly, I lived in Arizona for quite some time, and overwhelmingly, the people that are coming here illegally, they're all from Sonora. I'd say easily over 80%.
Oh, really? That's northern Mexico, because I was under the impression that the recent immigrants tend to be from places like Oaxaca in the south.
Well, what happened, I mean, we don't really need to go into too much detail, but a lot of them were displaced by the policies of NAFTA when they lost their jobs and those.
Oh, you're talking about people here legally who are more likely to be middle class.
Right. I mean, the Mexicans that came here through legal channels may have had a completely different agenda. So, you know, it's possible that they're Oaxacan or from the Yucatan or something like that.
There could also be a difference between California and Arizona, too.
Sure. And speaking of, I mean, Arizona has a huge population of Vietnamese. I don't really know why or how that trend started, but especially Tucson has a very, very large Vietnamese population. Which was something that you were discussing before, you know, Asians in the Southwest.
Yeah, Asians have come to the West Coast in general. I mean, certainly like the Left Coast, and, you know, part of the Left Coast is also in Canada, so it includes like Vancouver and things like that. So those places have really large Asian populations.
I think they came here for the rail. You know, initially, the earliest Asian populations there were for building the railroads.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was part of the thing that led into the immigration, the earlier areas of immigration restrictionism, because they were competing with white Americans for jobs at the time, at a time when there was no welfare state. So that was like the part of the early immigration restrictions. But yeah, they were early Asians, and now of course you have Asians that are coming over more recently. Like a lot of the earlier populations were more Japanese. Like we don't get a lot of Japanese now.
Reading actually prior to the Immigration Act of 65, Japanese were the majority of Asian Americans.
Yeah. I mean, now it's more Chinese and Vietnamese and Philippines.
We were talking about how different regions attract different groups.
Yeah.
Based on current day trends, what are your thoughts on what specific regions of America attract which particular groups? Are there particular aspects about those regions? Like, say, what kind of people are attracted to California, and what kind of people are attracted to, say, the Sunbelt cities of the South, or people are attracted to New York City?
You mean in ethnic groups, or in what individual type of personality?
Immigrant groups that are attracted to those regions.
Well, it's kind of hard to say for immigrant groups, because a lot of immigration is driven by, convenience and previous context, like family context. You have a lot of chain migrations or people you know and things like that. So it's a little harder to say it's localized at certain places. My family came up, so they pretty much landed in New York, and that's where that branch of Jamaican immigrants went. It's really hard to predict what groups are going where.
But as far as you were kind of touching on migration patterns, different personality types are attracted to different places. So yeah, if someone wants to move to New York City, they have a very specific image of what they want to do with their lives, and that's going to attract a certain personality type.
Yeah, I mean, it can definitely tell you individual characteristics. I mean, like in general city versus rural living, I mean, you know, you have that type of segregation where people who are more, you know, more career oriented, more, you know, I don't want to say more sociable, but certainly more tolerant of learning a large number of people, they're more likely to go into a city. And, certain cities do have different things. Los Angeles the characteristics that you have in a city like any society in general, come from the people who live there and the types of people who live there. The reason that you have LA that is more, the Hollywood, basically, you know, more superficial and appearance concern and things like that are because of the type of people that are drawn to a place like that. And, the vice versa, the people who live in more rural areas tend to be more family oriented, like a slower pace of life, and that's where you get those type of people.
Well, I find often that when you trace these groups back to Europe, very oftentimes they'll move to an area that the environment, the natural environment resembles where they were before. Like for instance, mentioned earlier, the north, like the Great Lakes region, has a lot of Swedes, and the weather there is very very similar to Sweden.
In earlier times, when you didn't have modern conveniences like air conditioning and things like that, and subsistence was more agrarian, you had to go to where you knew. So, the type of place you knew. So,
right.
The upper Midwest got a lot of Scandinavians. The lower Midwest area, had a lot of Germans because they originally came. The first wave of Germans came from the Palatine. Later waves of Germans came more from Eastern and Northern Germany. But they generally moved to places of similar climate or similar modes of subsistence, more or less.
With American Nations series, it's interesting to look at different areas by wealth and income equality. So you get places like the Deep South and the Appalachians with high levels of poverty. You get places like California and New York where there's a large disparity between wealth and the poor. Then you get places, pretty much the Mormon areas like Utah and the largely German-American or Scandinavian parts of the upper Midwest, which have the strongest middle class. In your series, do you write about these factors of how the culture and ethnic makeup of those areas affect the income wealth disparities?
Yeah, no, definitely. One of my posts was specifically on that. It was titled "Demography is Destiny." It looked at there was a paper that actually estimated the actual ancestral composition of the different parts of the United States based on census data by looking at longitudinal census data. Because if you look at the census report from any one census, you're not going to get an accurate point of ancestry because people don't report their ancestry, at least within racial differences. If you look at European and they say they're ex-Irish or ex-German, it's not going to be exactly accurate because they either don't know or they're not recounting it properly. But if you look at it longitudinally, you can get a more accurate picture. And you find that the ancestry of an area, even between these various European ancestries, because some European groups are more productive than others, is going to vary according to that. Ancestry is a big predictor. And, certainly in the parts of the upper Midwest, the more German and more Scandinavian are going to have, you find higher IQs on average, you find higher GDP per capita in these areas, higher average wealth. And when you look at more Scotch-Irish places like in Appalachia, where you have much lower, lower education completion, lower incomes, lower economic vitality. Ancestry is highly predictive of these things.
So how do you feel about, for instance, this is just one example of this, like an insurance company setting your health insurance rate based on your genetics? Is that fair? Are there any ethics that we need to consider?
Well, insurance companies are out to make money. I'm pro a single-payer health insurance, so maybe I'm the bad person to ask that question.
You mentioned 23andMe. Most people don't know this, but that company is actually owned by the Google's CEO's ex-wife. Right, yeah. So... I think a lot of people are starting to connect the dots here and assuming or projecting that, they want to start targeting ads or setting your web behavior based on your genetics.
Go ahead.
That poses a lot of really difficult and thorny questions there, right? For instance, is it fair, say a Native American who I guess some medical experts will say has a predisposition towards alcoholism. So therefore, should we set his insurance rate higher? Or should people exclude that person, say, I don't really want to share in this person's risk, which is a fair concern, right? Why would you want to share your financial risk with people who are going to have a high tendency to just drink their lives away? And I'm not that's Native American, but just posing that sort of a question.
Yeah, those sort of genetic things are bound to happen. It's inevitable as we're starting to actually identify the causal genetic variants behind traits. Because at this point, we know that the genes are heavily involved, but we don't quite know which genes. Identified quite a few at this point, but certainly not the majority. So just a tiny portion of them. But that's good. That's rapidly changing. And at some point, we're going to identify more and more things. And we're going to be able to predict a whole lot about a person by just simply looking at their genome. That's definitely coming. Just to mention the policy thing real quick. Just one way around that is just simply, mandate medical care for everyone. So you don't have to worry about insurance companies doing things like that. But in general, businesses and other things who can gain access to your genetic information anyway, who can do these things based on your genetics, those are things that are definitely going to come to pass.
Well, right, and it seems that, the problem is that they're doing it without people's knowledge. I think somebody posted this a while ago that when you do the 23andMe service, you're giving them the right, very similar to Facebook, that anything you submit to them is their, they have the right to relicense that information out to other
people. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm definitely more of the mind that each person should own their genome, that, you know, they should be the person that's saying that. But, you know, yeah, I mean, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, they set out for the express purpose of building a massive database. And they're doing it, and when you have that a huge database, you can do a lot of things with it. And a lot of things are going to be done with it, so it's inevitable.
J-Man, before I wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to add about your American Nations series that's worth bringing up that we didn't touch on? And there's so much here.
Yeah, well, one of the things, let me just finish up the laws of behavioral genetics, actually, because people should get those things. Right, so the first one lists all human behavioral genetic traits are heritable. Second one is this defective family, small and defective genes. The third law is that a substantial portion of the variants is not affected by genes or families, which basically means that identical twins, even raised together, aren't actually identical. You know, they have different fingerprints. They do have some different behavioral traits. There's going to be some variance left over. A lot of it doesn't appear to be from the classic things in the environment. It just seems to be developmental noise, as it's called. It's just developmental variance. You know, the fingerprints illustrate it. There's just little random or otherwise unknown fluctuations during developments that may make the same genome do different things if it's in different bodies, as in the case of identical twins. The fourth law is one of the new laws that's come out of genomics that says that the typical human behavioral trait is associated with many different causal variants. It basically says that for most traits, there isn't a gene for this thing. There are very few traits, certainly for behavioral traits, that only one or two genes do a thing. Most behavioral traits come from the effects of many genes, maybe thousands of genes that lead to the things, each one with a tiny effect. And the fifth law is something that Emil Kierkegaard coined. It says that all phenotypic relationships are somehow genetically confounded and mediated. And that one's a big one because it goes right to the core of how social science and medical science are conducted, because it's currently conducted with the belief that if you find a correlation between two factors, two phenotypic factors, like, you know, someone grows up in poverty, they tend to lead to a life of crime. And so they infer from that that the poverty is what caused the crime, ignoring the fact that those things are genetically mediated. So it's not that the poverty caused the crime, it's that the genes caused both the poverty and the crime, your circumstances are caused by your genes, or in this case, your parents' genes leads them to be in a certain circumstance and needs to be the circumstance that you're in. In medical science, associated with association between some behavior or some lifestyle condition and some health outcome, are assumed to be, the things like the saturated fat thing, that's a big one, or pretty much any dietary or lifestyle things associated with some health outcome. And it's assumed that those things are, the behavior is what causes the health outcome. They don't consider that it's in fact that the genes cause both.
J-Man, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me.
And also thanks, Joshua Zeidner and Sam Kevorkian.
Great to be on again. Nice to meet you, J-Man.
Oh, nice to meet you too. Take care.
Same here.